Be.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me is James. Before we start our new podcast here, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We most recently talked about Swingers, and then before that, we talked about Mad Max: Fury Road. We've also talked about Ex Machina, It Follows, and The Graduate recently. So yeah, you can find all of those at themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen. And subscribe to us on iTunes. Tell your friends about us. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Tell your friends to do the same. Yeah, that's about it. So we'll get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
I love that banjo version of our theme song.
It was really great. I'm really happy Travis gave us a new version.
Learned banjo just for this.
He can probably play a banjo.
Yeah, I don't know.
He can play a lot of things. Don't worry. He's a musically talented sort of man.
Anyway.
Yeah.
As you probably picked up from the theme song.
Yeah. Which we should point out has not actually changed at all.
They know. They know. We were talking about Deliverance.
Yes.
Directed by John Boorman.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the novel Deliverance by James Dickey, which came out 2 years before.
Mm-hmm.
Who's a very celebrated American South author and poet. Our choice to do this movie kind of was sort of last minute.
Well, not last minute, but it was
we have a list of movies that we've been working through, and this one came out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, I assumed this was on the list when you suggested it, but
I don't think it was. Okay. But anyway,
well, it was on your half joking list that you sent me on Sunday, and it's the one we picked.
Okay. Yeah, this is a movie that I forget how it came to mind. Someone brought it up, and I realized I understand that it is a iconic and very famous movie with some iconic music and dialogue, especially. And I know very little else about this movie at that point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
With this?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
What's your history with this movie?
I saw it on Tuesday. Beginning of history. And here we are at the continuation of that. No, I always knew it was well respected, and have a memory of one time when I worked at a video store, like holding it to rent it. And a guy I work with, who I trust a lot, his opinions on movies, being like, "Oh, that's a great movie. You should definitely rent that." And I'm like, "Yeah, I should." And then putting it back and getting something else, and then just never seeing Deliverance until this week. But yeah.
Yeah, I kind of lost the grasp of how well-respected it was. I thought it just kind of had some moments that a lot of people remembered. But most critics, with the exception of Roger Ebert, really, really, really liked this movie.
Yeah, and I can see why. And John Boorman knows how to put together a movie. I'm a big Point Blank fan. Have you seen Point Blank?
No.
It's awesome.
Are you saying Point Break or Point Blank?
No, Point Blank.
Okay, then no.
The one with Lee Marvin and not Bodie and Johnny Utah. But yeah, no, I like Point Blank a lot. So I, as an adult, was very interested in actually eventually seeing this. And I liked it. I think he knows how to put together a movie.
And when you say you know why it's well-respected, is it does a lot of the things that commonly well-respected movies do, or is it just you really enjoyed it yourself personally, or
well, it does that thing that intelligent people enjoy in their action movies, where you get pretty much all of the action at about the middle, and then the rest of the movie is dealing with the repercussions of that action. You know, it's not, the movie doesn't end on an action scene. The movie ends on them trying to get away with what they've done, you know. And it's most action movies that are meant just to thrill is you get the action and then you assume there are no consequences, you know? You see the big explosion and then the hero's walking off into the distance, whereas you never really think, oh, how many like civilians did that explosion kill? Does he get any sort of PTSD from the potential collateral damage? from blowing up Alcatraz or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Deliverance very much has that worrying about the consequences of what you've done, which is always an interesting way to look at an action movie.
And a very 70s thing, I find, eh?
Mm-hmm.
For reasons we've probably discussed in other 70s movies that we've done, but that was very much a, Vietnam, Watergate era, very much actually dealing with consequences and, America not just, as you say, winning the war and walking off in the distance, kind of dealing with repercussions. And John Voight, who's in this movie, made Coming Home, which was dealing with, Vietnam War veterans coming home and dealing with all the things that happen when you go through such a traumatic experience.
So. Yeah, exactly. And it's also a time in the filmmaking landscape when you could make those types of films and have them be kind of cultural moments. I mean, Hal Ashby, who directed Coming Home, and John Borman, who directed this, like, their movies, if they were coming out now, would be like, released by the Weinstein Company in November, maybe, and it would be like a Most Violent Year is what these movies would be. It would be, they'd come out when they come out, and the only hope anybody has of getting them seen is to get them awards nominations. And in the 1970s, that there were more of those movies, and they were more successful in general. Yeah,
and we've said that this was well received critically at the time, and certainly has gone down. I do think it is kind of overshadowed by, a song and a line and...
And what, sorry?
A male rape scene, which are all, effective in this movie, but shouldn't overshadow everything else this movie accomplishes. But yeah, it has gone down. I mean, it's part of the National Film Registry and launched the careers for a lot of these people as well, right?
Yeah, for sure. Ronnie Cox and Ned Beatty had never acted on screen before. Burt Reynolds isn't Burt Reynolds until this movie. And John Voight, I mean, Midnight Cowboy is 1969, but it is my understanding that he fell into a little bit of a lull after that, and this really helped pick him back up.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the movie. What did you like so much about it?
Well, first, I just love all the canoeing scenes. This is... It does a lot of the things that I love movies that deal with nature a lot to do, in that, one, not a lot of music, and two, a heavy emphasis on sound effects and continual sound effects. We talked about this a bit with Mad Max Fury Road, but this is kind of a different version, and it's something that Terrence Malick would, soon after this movie comes out, start to really become the master of, is just... having this nonstop sound of nature, and it's always in the background, and it's never really the focus of the audio track, but the fact that it is just there and it's so pervasive, it sort of really creates this feel for the picture as a whole. And that's something that I love about Deliverance, and I think comes across very well. And just all those, it's all a very well shot film, but those canoeing scenes in general, I feel like there's just such a environment set for the movie to exist in, that it makes everything that actually physically happens in it has more weight, simply because there's just such this stylistic through line running through it,
Yeah, and like a lot of 70s movies, you can tell how much of this is just real, like all the canoeing that the actors were doing and were not insured for at the time, which is a pretty insane story.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they couldn't get insured because they're just like, well, this is too crazy. We're not going to insure you because you're definitely going to break your coccyx, Burt Reynolds.
Yeah. Yes, and they were correct.
Yeah.
Do you consider this like a man versus nature kind of movie? You said it's a nature movie. Do you think kind of the... very basic plots that, most movies fall into. Do you think that's what's going on here? Is there something else?
I don't know. I really don't feel like there's much versus in the nature aspect of things. I think it's man and nature more than man versus nature to me. They're never threatened by trees,
Yeah. Well, they're the rapids.
Yeah, exactly. But that's never the most, most threatening part of their journey.
I don't know. I think it takes out a few people.
Yeah, it does. I don't know.
Yeah, no.
I don't see this as a man versus nature movie, though.
No, I agree. Like, I would agree for the most part, and I think it's certainly not the most interesting part of this movie. And I think with a lot of things in this movie, what's good can also be bad. Mm-hmm. Like, there are tons of things in this movie, just certain lines especially, which, too many. There's, you know, a lot of specific lines in this movie that just have a dual was positive at the time when we look back at the context of it, having seen the entire movie certainly takes on a different meaning. I'm thinking right at the start with the dueling banjo scene where it's kind of a tense moment between, you know, the city slickers and the mountain men. Mm-hmm. And they're very different groups of people. And it certainly seems like the gap between them is being bridged, with this duet that they're playing, you know, one on guitar and one on banjo, and things are going really well with the song. It's picking up the pace and they're doing this call and answer thing and understanding each other really well. And then the banjo player, the, you know, mountain boy, I guess, yeah. Just seems better at his instrument and gets ahead of him and is playing much more quickly. And, the guitar player can't keep up and says, you know, I'm lost. And he says it, you know, as though he's laughing and that, you know, things are going so well. This is funny. This jam's going great, but I just can't keep up with you. On its own, that plays out kind of nicely that they're having fun together. But what we, you know, after we've seen what happens in this movie, certain people are more used to the country. Certain people aren't used to being outside of the city. Mm-hmm. The banjo is a much more, you know, a mountain man instrument than the guitar is, simply. And these people are from there. They know this area well. And even though they're not the exact same group of people as the two people, our two main villains, I guess, in this movie as far as humans go, mm-hmm. I think we're supposed to see them as one group. And that's the time just a few minutes into the movie that there's something very positive and, his line of saying I'm lost. And then we get a bit further into the movie and we understand all the ramifications of what this means for these people to be really out of their element. And there's a few things like that I think fit really, really well once you've seen the entire film.
Yeah, exactly. And the dueling banjo scene, just in general, like you see these two different types of people playing this music together, and they're playing this music on different versions of the same kind of instrument. You know, it's not like a guitar and the banjo are the same thing, but they are both doing the same thing. They're playing music and they're just coming at it in a slightly different way, not unlike Mountain Man and Ed come at climbing cliffs and whatnot. You know, they're both in the same environment and just approaching it differently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've probably heard people say music's the like a universal language. You see them communicating, you see so much like how they are on the same page, but when he tries to shake his hand or speak with him, you can tell that they're just such different people. And that, you know, there are some very basic human things that everyone has in common, but then we just get this indication of the huge gap between the two people and, you know, the two groups of men and the two parts of society that kind of play out for the rest of this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I really like that part a lot. And there's, a few more lines like that. And I think it's important to, well, what do you think that, the mountain men are really supposed to be aligned with nature a lot? Like, I know I'm coming back to this man versus nature idea, but there's so many things that make it seem like, if we're going to take it from a man versus nature kind of story, that the mountain men are still just part of nature. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, looking at it that way, it's kind of like at the very beginning, we get the shots of the river, construction of the dam, and then an explosion before we get the forest and Lewis and Ed and all their cars pulling into it. What that's meant to get across is that these are city boys coming to join the forest, and it's being paired with this this dam construction, and it's just sort of that they are infringing on nature, you know, and they are here to have their way with nature. And the quote unquote, if we'll call them villains, main villain of this movie is named Mountain Man in the credits. You know, he's aligned with nature that way. And
yeah,
it's just sort of these city boys coming to the forest and the human equivalent of that nature that they're walking into is going to fight back a little bit, you know?
Yeah, and for all the kind of negative stereotyping of, you know, hillbillies or mountain men or whatever you want to call them, there is the positive stereotype that they're self-sufficient and they can function in nature with, you know, very limited technology and things like that. So they do kind of have this one positive aspect where they seem to be more in touch with, you know, nature than our city slickers, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And one other line that kind of reminds me of that is when I forget who says it, but it's one of our, you know, our city slickers, and they say
it was Billy Crystal.
It was Billy Crystal said, yeah. "You look marvelous." No.
I think City Slickers is the only movie that he's in that he doesn't call. He says somebody looks marvelous.
No, but they say no matter what's happening in the world, no one can find us up here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of that duality I was speaking of. And it applies to these guys who can't really cut it in nature, it seems. They like this idea that the outside world can't get to them here, but that's also ends up being an awful thing for them when they need help. Mm-hmm. And when the mountain men who are much more talented at surviving in nature, you know, end up coming after them, and they're pretty helpless.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, the point of when Ed walks back to where the cars end up being Aintree, I think it is. He is walking across the land. If it's not the exact same land that we see in the intro, it's something that's clearly meant, the shots are clearly meant to sort of mirror it. And the idea in the intro is that man is having its way with nature, and then Ed has to still, he has to deal with this nature, but without all of his tools, all the construction equipment that we see at the beginning. And he still has to be able to get across this. And he just has to do it in a much more old-fashioned way. He has to walk, you know, he's got to hike.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. What do you think of the character of Ed?
I mean, the way Dickie, I forget his first name. Right now.
James
Dickey describes it. He says Ed is a natural born killer just waiting to get out. And that's kind of what we're meant to see through this movie, I think, is that we get a very normal family man who now has to learn how to be a capital M man, I suppose, or just learn how to survive in the wilderness. Like, we see the moment where he has a deer in his sights early on, their first morning together, and he fails to follow through on killing the deer. And he was never really threatened at that point. It was just like he was either going to kill this deer or nobody was going to die. And then we get again another mirror scene later on, where he has to kill the toothless guy. I don't know how he's credited, but and it clearly is a situation where it's me or him. And now that the stakes have risen a bit, he kind of has to learn how to become that killer. And and it's not like he doesn't you know, and then he has to learn how to cover that up, right? Or at least compose some sort of story that will help him cover it up. Yeah,
and I think that's really the most interesting arc in this movie by far. Like, I think it does a good job of keeping me interested throughout. Like, I think it's a very engaging movie, that's for sure. But yeah, I think Ed's journey is a pretty interesting one, because we meet him as this very, he seems like a very decent guy. You know, they said he's a good dad and a good wife, a good husband. He's got a great job and house. And like, he's very much aligned with a lot of the positive things about society. And then, yeah, his journey, as you said, like, he has to become this capital N M man, this guy who can survive in nature, this guy who's, you know, willing to kill and do all these physical things to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And then he seems to accomplish that. And, you know, they, for the most part, their party gets out alive, with one exception. But, you know, they make it, and they don't use tools, you know, technology and things like that. They just use their canoes and their bow and arrow and things like that. And he seems to kind of achieve that. But then the rest of his journey, I think, is him kind of having to get back into society. And mm-hmm. so it's him having gone from, you know, this very social creature inside civilization with all its, you know, social constructs, and then to become this, you know, this wild man, this kind of noble savage who is willing to do everything to just to get by. But then we have him coming back and, you know, being reinserted back into society. And it seems, you know, somewhat tragically that his growth out of that and back into society is a very guilt-ridden one, you know, and he has to lie to, you know, to the police, to, you know, these hospital workers. He has to lie to all these institutions in order to be an acceptable member of society again. And we also see that he's never going to be able to tell his wife and family what really happened. Mm-hmm. That's what I like so much about that credit sequence, is just him staying awake, you know, kind of unable to live with himself.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the deeper he gets into nature, the more lawless he's okay with being. Like, there's the scene after the rape where they're trying to decide whether or not to bury the mountain man's body, and Ed has the deciding vote, and he decides to bury him. And that's sort of the beginning of his entrance into this sort of natural born killer sort of idea. He will go from that to trying to survive to actually killing the toothless guy. And then the closer he gets back to society, the more he has to start dealing with the consequences, and the more those consequences start to eat him up, because he's getting reintegrated back into the life that he had temporarily left when he ended up in this crazy situation. And he sort of starts to think more along the way that Ed thinks at like negative 5 minutes of this movie before we even see him get into the mountains. The way that him on Friday afternoon would see it, you know, it's like, I killed a man, you know, like, and that's something that's going to stick with you. Not only did I kill a man, but a canoe trip that I in some manner helped orchestrate killed my friend, you know.
Yeah. So, no. Yeah, and I think you know, talking about the Vietnam vet generation, I don't think there's that much of a stretch. Mm-hmm. But and just the idea of, you know, this movie reminded me of Apocalypse Now in another way. You know, it's a 70s movie based on a novel, you know, going down a river, things just getting worse and worse pretty much. Mm-hmm. They're different movies, I understand, but it reminds me of that, and just we're into the heart of darkness and kind of losing himself a little bit throughout, as you were saying, all those kinds of decisions he made. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, to touch on this idea that it's not just a man versus nature kind of movie, it's interesting that, you know, the most frightening villain, which I think is the mountain man, it's not that we're afraid of the things in nature, like, you know, bears and floods and the rapids. We're afraid of nature because it kind of lets men be natural or more animalistic, and they're not afraid of all these elements in nature. They're afraid of what humanity is capable of when we don't have, you know, society to keep us in check. And I think that's one of the really dark things about this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's this one of my favorite moments in the movie is when Ed, right towards the end, right before he's about to go home, he walks past a gravesite, a cemetery that's, you know, it's part of the town that's starting to be flooded, and they're digging up graves and digging up coffins and to move them to new places. And what I find really fascinating about that scene is that it's him learning that even though, you know, the people that he has killed are dead and buried, just because something's buried doesn't mean it's going to stay underground forever. And I think that's a really interesting idea. And I don't mean literally, I don't mean he's coming back to life or anything.
Like, but the last shot of this movie suggests.
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't think that's suggesting that he's coming back to life. It's just that, one of the ropes slipped. But, yeah, that that will rise up, whether it rises up in the form of guilt or whether you think that that body really does start floating and they find out that it was kind of a murder, you know, and then people come to get him.
Yeah, no, I think that's like one of the best scenes in this movie, especially just because of how efficient it is. Like, it's a really short scene that gives you a lot of things to think about.
Yeah, and it's not even particularly clear. Like, if you're not watching that scene really clearly immediately, you don't really see any and it's so quick, you don't really see them remove a coffin. You see the ending of removing of a coffin, but you don't see what I think would be the easy shot to get this across quickly, is somebody actually lifting the coffin out of the actual grave. You get some transition moments and coffins being put on the truck and then people starting to dig to a new grave, but you never see like the most obvious shot for them to do of a removal of a coffin, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's a very kind of spoon feedy way of doing that. Be like, oh, I remember this guy as they pull up a coffin, things like that. But yeah. No, I think you're right though. They just do it with like a ton of subtlety, and it just, I think it gives you a ton of things to think about. Like, there is what you said, you know, this idea of, you know, something being buried doesn't mean it's gone for good. Like, if you want to talk about PTSD and guilt, like, there's all these things that are in your past, but still very much a part of your present and presumably part of your future until you die as well. Because just the emotional shock of, you know, so many of the things that you can experience in life. And I also think just the idea of moving a church, like, for what is basically a unnecessary reason. Like, they're choosing to flood this lake. It's not like they're doing this to evacuate because something unstoppable is about to take place. You know, I think that there's this idea that there's respect for God or the natural world, but only until it starts being inconvenient, mm-hmm. or until there's a way to make money by not respecting the natural world. And I think that that's something that runs through this movie as well.
Yep.
So with that scene, why does the driver think that the city should be drowned? You know, he says, you know, we have the sheriff say, I want to see this town die peaceful. Mm-hmm. Without much remorse in his voice that the town is going to die at all. And then we have the driver say something along the lines of like...
The cab driver?
Yeah, I think so. Says like, or I don't know if it's a cab, but yeah. You know,
yeah, whatever the country equivalent of a cab is. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, he says something about, you know, how it's going to be the best day in the city's history. What is your take on these locals being so remorseless or happy about what's presumably their hometown being put underwater for the rest of civilization?
I think it's a little bit of... I think you find in, and this is me coming from what is admittedly very little experience in small town living, but just from people that I know and the small amount of time that I've spent in small towns, there tends to be kind of a division, and there's people that want everything to stay exactly the same always, and people that cannot wait for the town to change or to get out of the town entirely. And I think that's kind of just supposed to show this inner division between the people of the town. There's this guy that, you know, he lives here for whatever reason, probably just because it's the only world he's ever known and has never really thought to leave. But he still kind of hates the town and is totally okay with it being totally changed. And then there's this other side of things that... was born there and always knew it was going to stay there, and they always knew they were going to stay there, and as such they kind of love it because they have nothing, they know no other way, and they never want to know another way, so they continue to hold on to their way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah,
and I think this idea that there's, you know, two groups of people in a small town, like, this movie definitely shows some Southerners, some hillbillies, some Georgians in a very negative light, obviously, with the two mountain men that commit rape and clearly are like physically intimidate and clearly are not apprehensive about physically hurting someone. But then almost everybody else we meet in this movie from that area seems like a very nice person. Like, this isn't Southerners are all redneck, terrible people. Everyone seems helpful to Ed at the hospital and that boarding house or whatever he's staying at. Mm-hmm. They all seem sympathetic and really nice. And the sheriff, played by James Dickey.
Played by Asak Hank Schrader, you mean. He looks so much like him to me. And they have the same acting style. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, Little Hank.
No, I mean, he's an adversary in this just because our main characters are trying to get away with a lie. Mm-hmm. And he is a cop trying to figure out what has happened in his team.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess not having seen this movie and only knowing it from, you know, spoofs and iconic moments, I thought it was going to be just a lot of really, really bad Southern people and then good city folk. And that's not what it was at all.
Yeah, I think I was expecting closer to what it was just because, again, Point Blank comes up, which is a movie that John Boorman directed about 5 years previous to this film. And it's so weird and bananas. And it's like this... It's like The Graduate, but about a tough guy. I don't know, like stylistically, there's a lot of through lines to be drawn. It's just all over the place, but really in a really wonderful way. So I was expecting Deliverance to be, I would say, even weirder than what I expected filmmaking-wise. But I certainly didn't expect it to be a straight-line action movie, and it's definitely not that, you know?
Yeah, I don't even know that it's an action movie, really.
It's for the 70s, this is an action movie.
Okay, yeah, true, true. What about visually? You just kind of you brought up filmmaking there. What other than the plot really got you about this movie?
Well, I mean, the stuff that I pointed out, I just enjoy. For a guy that hates nature as much as I do, I enjoy a well-framed shot of nature.
Yeah, but it's not. I don't know. I don't find it particularly gorgeous. Like, I
no,
think...
it's not. It's just sort of this existence within nature that I was talking about, where it's just sort of it doesn't need every individual shot doesn't need to be pretty. It just sort of needs to be this style that continues, and the sound is so important to that. Like the way they shot the canoe scenes reminds me of a lot of The Thin Red Line. Like, there's elements of that really exist. But the things I liked about the cinematography in this movie are mostly, you know, there aren't a lot of like meaning exclamation point moments in this movie in the cinematography, but it's just really well staged. I like all the wide shots where there's a lot of people in them and a lot of movement going on. Like when they first arrive to the first hillbilly house where they get gas, and we see them all get out of the car in a wide shot, and we see Bobby, Ned Beatty's character, walk over to the old rusted car, talk about how all of his youth and passion has been rusted up like that. And you see all this movement around, and then the guy that ends up giving Lewis gas comes out of nowhere. And all of these things happen, and the camera pans only a little bit, and we still see all four of these characters. And the clouds even move during this shot, which is extremely rare. The clouds move and the sun comes out and they don't cut, which is very rare because that changes the lighting entirely. And it's just stuff like that that is a very old-fashioned style of filmmaking, because it involves basically rehearsing your blocking, which nobody seems to want to or have the time to do anymore. And I love stuff like that. And the other comparable moment to that is it's both pre, during, and post rape scene, where you see a lot of wide shots kind of obscured by they're being shot through the leaves and the trees. Like, the camera can't quite look at this stuff head on, you know. And there's a lot of that in other parts of the movie too, but specifically surrounding the rape scene.
Yeah, and particularly in that scene after our, you know, mountain man number one has been killed, and they have that discussion about what to do with the body. I really enjoyed how many shots that body was still in frame.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, they're having this debate over what to do and what's morally the right thing and what's not going to get them caught and all these things. And it's just, it takes up a big part of the frame. And even when they change angles, like, it's still there. And he dies in such an awkward position. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of speaks to, like, I mean, awkward definitely understates it, but like, what a difficult, uncomfortable position they're in. Like, they have this thing, like this dead body, this event in their past, this action that they took, that now is just like there, and it's in a weird, uncomfortable spot, and you can't look away from it as much as you want to. And it's just this, it's, you know, it's not just this little problem that's going to be wrapped up and thrown away, you know what I mean? Like, it's this thing in a really tough, awkward position that you are going to have to keep facing. And even as they have their debate and they're, you know, they're trying to keep their mind on this issue and societal norms and what's going to get them caught and what isn't, there's just always this thing, like this dead body, this idea, this problem that is just, you know, right in the lens that, you know, you don't get a chance to forget about for a second.
Yeah, exactly. And I really like that scene, that whole discussion scene. And mostly because that was one of the things that I was just not anticipating about this movie at all, was that there would be a death and then immediately discussing, you know, basically running through a checklist of all of the things that could come, all the consequences that could come out of this death, and everybody proposing their side. And I was like, this is awesome. This is people debating things in an action movie. I'm all for it. Yeah, I really like that scene as well. And one other thing about that scene that I love is that Drew is the only person that really objects to burying the mountain man because he's worried about the consequences. And the person that's most worried about the society that he has come from is the one that doesn't make it out of nature alive. And I like that part about it quite a bit as well.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said about society's ideas, Ned Beatty, is that Lewis?
Ned Beatty is Bobby. Lewis is
Yes. Bobby. Yeah, I mean, Bobby has gone, you know, through this pretty traumatic experience and then, you know, witnessed a death and now is possibly on the hook for, you know, murder. It, you know, we know that that's not the case, but who knows how this works out. And as they said, all these people in town are more likely to side with the locals. And he's still really concerned about what happened to him getting around. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't want the stigma of having been a rape victim. And it's just incredible, and I assume accurate, that's something that, you know, even with all these other huge questions and gigantic problems, that he's still hung up on that. And, you know, I think that just says something about sex and masculinity in society.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah, we kind of get to see that's part of the, not that thing specifically, but that scene and the what happens immediately after, we kind of get them, you know, devolving into animals again. Like when we see them, like we have Squeal like a pig, you know, the famous line, but, you know, those mountain men seem to trying to debase them down to like a you know, they're animal beings. But then after the murder and we have this dead body on our hands, just the way that they're digging with their hands.
Yeah.
They just look so animalistic, and the way that they're breathing and just like scratching at it. You know, we just see kind of just in a few minutes how quickly they devolve from these, you know, Atlanta businessmen whose idea of, you know, being outdoors is playing golf on a fenced in manicured sporting field to, you know, killing people and digging their graves with their bare hands. And I think that's it's a really cool transition.
Yeah, exactly. And even after the after they finish digging that grave, as they're running back to the canoes, you see Ed kind of stop and briefly try and wash his hands, and it's just so, it looks so futile.
Yeah.
And it so clearly is, because I mean, the dirt has already been done and you can't remove it from yourself, you know. It's just the decision's been made, and you were a big part of making that decision, and you can't turn back from that. And yeah, I really enjoyed that part of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was surprised by how much I like this movie. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
You got anything else about it?
I love Burt Reynolds.
He's pretty wonderful.
He's the best. And that's like one of the great tragedies of Burt Reynolds' career, is that he has terrible taste in movies. And he's in so few good movies, but I enjoy him so much. Like, he has this very specific kind of charisma that so few people have. And there's a confidence in him that, like, I know he is a terrible person, but I would watch him in any movie, you know, like, and he's just so engaging. And also in this movie, he does some all-time driving in a straight line while violently turning the steering wheel. And I enjoyed that quite a bit. I wonder if he learned before he got onto Smokey and the Bandit. But there's just one other shot that I really enjoyed about this movie that I feel like deserves to be brought up, is the shot of Ed when they're
he's getting to that house after the hospital where him and Bobby are staying for a night. And he's about to walk through a screen door and he sees this big group of people sitting around, what I assume is a family, sitting around and having a dinner together. And Bobby is there. And we get this shot from the inside, framed out, looking at Ed. And we very clearly see the screen door in front of him. And this is a shot that's actually in Point Break as well. Or sorry, Point Blank as well. And the screen door is very much a part of the focus. And he has to walk through the screen to get to this family sitting and enjoying a meal. And it's kind of like him re-entering society. And that's where all of the guilt sort of comes out of, is after that scene, when he has to try and re-enter this sort of society that he's more used to, of a family sitting around a table, having a meal and talking. And even right after walking through that door, not too long into the meal, we see him break down in tears, and he kind of realizes what he's done, and the guilt comes out of that. And I think that sort of sets the tone for the last 20 minutes of the movie or so. And it's this moment that I think is really says a lot about what the movie's about, and something about not necessarily the action star, because Ed isn't an action star, but the people in action movies and what happens when they have to go home and walk through that door and sit and eat a meal and aren't, you know, caught up in the adrenaline of the situation anymore. And I think that's the thing that Deliverance does very well. It's the thing we've been talking about a lot. It's the thing that makes the movie really interesting. And it's the thing that still makes it really interesting to watch now, outside of it just being this interesting part of history where it was this cultural sensation. It's a movie that is still good, you know? And it's because of decisions like that where you could make so many cultural sensation movies about action movies about hillbillies versus city boys, you know, and there's just a lot more shootouts and whatnot. But that's what kind of makes Deliverance stand apart from the pack, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then when I was reading some people's thoughts on this movie, even some people who like it overall have complained about the ending, and that they say it's kind of anticlimactic and the end goes on a bit longer after they've made it out of the river safe. But that is definitely not where the heart of this movie lies. It's not getting off the river safe. It's, as you said, going through that screen door, going back home. And it's that, I mean this in a good way, that lack of closure that this movie provides. It's not like, oh, well, what I went through, that traumatic experience is over, and now there's this part of my life. There's just kind of a slow fade where it's less and less on your mind. We're going to be gone, and there isn't that part where there's a clear line between that guy who did this horrible thing and this guy who's back home, you know, being a normal part of society again, and how those lines don't exist in real life and how things don't just get wrapped up neatly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like this episode.
So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Jurassic World. All right. James is going to see it in like 2 hours, everybody.
And then in 4 hours, and then in 6 hours.
So thank you for listening. So check back next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.